this afternoon to hear from the no side of the discussion on the referendum. And we have with us Mr. David Elliott. David is the national campaign director for the ACM No campaign, and they're just headquartered across the street. But he is also formerly was a senior advisor to Peter Collins, a former leader of the opposition. He's worked with John Howard and Bronwyn Bishop and was in the military for some time. And so he comes well prepared with a good background in our form of government and the changes that are being proposed and why we should not really look at those, but we should consider staying with our current form of government. So this afternoon, David, why don't you come and share with us?
Thanks, Jeff. I think we'll start by putting on our ad. For those of you who haven't seen it, our ads were launched on the weekend, on Sunday, and they're going to be they're starting today. In fact, they started this morning. So I'll just because I'll be speaking about the ads throughout my talk, so it's probably important that you have a look at them. Some of you will be aware that this campaign has been left to the last 3 weeks for the no vote, and that's because we don't have multi-millions of dollars to put a six-month campaign together. But having looked at that, I think you probably agree with me that it's certainly worth the wait. Last weekend, I went to Melbourne with James Blundell to launch the campaign. My wife was very concerned because for the first time in my life I asked her not to accompany me on a political visit. She thought it was all very suspicious. When you meet James Blundell, you can tell that you understand why the women swoon over him. So there's no way I was taking my wife down there to chase him around the hotel. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted that the media are here to cover today's some of my friends in the media are here to cover it. And I understand this is probably one of the only things that's going on today in the Republican campaign, because Neville Rand's speech in Wollongong was called off due to lack of interest. Something that I'm sure shocks a lot of you, and I'm sure it's shocking to him as well. I've done a lot of speeches over the last couple of months since I've been in this job over the last 6 months. Most of you know that I'm a very committed Anglican, and as I joked with Don Jamieson before and Eric Jones before, I'm not from an organised church. I'm an Anglican, and I before I give most of my speeches, I spend some time in prayer, and generally the longer the prayer, the better the speech. And I'm unfortunately I'm here to tell you that I didn't get time to pray today, so I apologise if it's not up to scratch. But it's an important issue, the Republic. It's an important issue because it's going to redefine Australia's political landscape. I joked with Fred before. I mean, I think this is the first political campaign where I've sat on a strategy committee with Fred Nile and senior members of the gay community. I can also tell you that it's the first time that Bill Hayden's found himself with some of the high Tories that are campaigning for the no vote. And it's we've had today a very senior union official who has been well known to many of you over the last 30 years has decided that he, in closer to the campaign, will be campaigning for the no vote, something that John Howard's going to have to deal with. That's the type of campaign that we've got. I think why are we right? Why do I think that the no case is right? Because there is such a broad organisation, a broad community group opposing it. And I'll address that later on because it's certainly a lot of criticism has been directed our way because we've campaigning with Republicans. We're campaigning with people who are ambivalent to whether or not we become a republic, but are just opposed to this republic that's coming up. Because there's always been this talk amongst the community, and Malcolm Turnbull over the last week, particularly when we announced our ads, you know, you're not mentioning the Queen. You're not mentioning the Queen. Well, I can tell you, as campaign director of ACM, campaign director of Australians for Constitutional Monarchy, I've spent the last 6 months talking about the Queen. I've spent the last 6 months reminding everybody that under the Queen of Australia, Australian society has evolved into something unique. We have a system of government that that is the envy of the world. We have a system of government which guarantees personal freedoms like no other nation. I'm not exaggerating here. The July edition of The Economist newspaper, a well-respected New York-based newspaper, said that Australia is number one in the world for personal freedoms. We've got that way because of our system of government. I wanted to tell everybody that under the constitutional monarchy of Australia, we are the sixth oldest democracy in the world, sixth oldest working democracy in the world. I wanted to tell everybody that under the constitutional monarchy and with the Queen of Australia, we have become a safe haven for people fleeing all types of repressive governments. We 5 million immigrants can't be wrong. I wanted to remind everybody that Australia was the first country to put its hand up for the East Timorese refugees. At the same time, we're also hosting refugees from the former Yugoslavia. They are all coming to Australia because we provide a system of government that is the envy of the world. But I haven't had the opportunity to speak publicly about the Queen as much as I would have liked to because the debate is, and rightly so, now focused on the question. This debate's been going on for 10 years, headed by Malcolm Fraser and Neville Wran and certainly Malcolm Turnbull. But now we're in the business end of the season. You know, we've got 24 more sleeps to go. We now have to debate the question that is going to be put in front of you. Yes, we can debate whether or not the Queen should be replaced by the Governor-General, the Queen and the Governor-General should be replaced by a President, but the devil's in the detail. And the debate and the community debate has now been focused on whether or not you want that President appointed by the politicians. The monarchy isn't on trial here. Kerry Jones has said that quite regularly, and I repeat it, the monarchy isn't on trial. This is not a debate on whether or not Queen Elizabeth has done a good job. Even Republicans admit that the Queen of Australia has done a good job. But if they are going to sacrifice a system of government that has worked so well, we want to know what it's going to be replaced with. We want to know why we should change, why we should risk our constitutional monarchy, and what are we going to replace it with. I wanted to preach the benefits of constitutional monarchy. I really did. I thought that was my job. I thought that's exactly what this campaign was going to be based on. But when you get involved in a political debate, You have to scratch beneath the surface, and that's exactly what's happened, and that's why we've got so many Republicans who are also voting no. I wanted to compare our system of government with systems of governments around the world, and I wanted to prove to everybody, and I'm confident that I would have been able to do that if I had the opportunity to talk about our constitutional monarchy, I wanted to prove to everybody that our system of government stands equal to, if not better than, any other system of government in the world. I wanted to prove to people that our system of government provides an apolitical head of state in the Governor-General and equal and fair treatment of all political parties. I wanted to highlight the fact that the 69 proposed changes are just a walk into darkness, something Malcolm Turnbull isn't telling you about, something that Republicans don't want you to know. There are 69 changes to this our Constitution recommended in this in the referendum question, 69 separate changes. Now, the Republicans will say, oh, well, they're all cosmetic. No, they're not cosmetic. 69 changes is serious business. Australians are rightly very cautious and conservative when it comes to constitutional change because we're an enlightened bunch, despite what some people might want you to know. Australians will look at what they're being offered. That's why we rejected things like the Australia Card. That's exactly why we rejected things like more government involvement in a whole range of things that have been proposed to us over the last 100 years. The reason why we've only passed eight referendums in 99 years is because we know what's good. We know what's right. Trust us. We know how we want to be governed. I also wanted to highlight the fact that the changes being proposed can't even be argued by the Republicans. Yesterday, Malcolm Turnbull was asked to look a gentleman in the eye and tell him that the system of government that he's proposing is better than what we have now. You might have seen it on TV. Malcolm stumbled, and the whole audience laughed. Now, he wants us to trust him. He wants us to have faith in the fact that his system of government, his proposals, are going to be better than what we've got now, and he couldn't. He failed the test. 25 days to go, and he failed the test. So what am I going to be speaking about over the next 24 hours if I'm not going to be... next 24 days if I'm not going to be proposing to argue and recommending to the people that constitutional monarchy is the best system of government? Well, as I said, through no fault of my own, the argument is now bogged down in the model. It's bogged down in the model because people don't like the fact that the politicians are going to elect the president. I mean, people in Australia, the best way to upset most Australian voters is tell them they can't have a say in something. And that was the fundamental flaw coming out of the Constitutional Convention. Don't be so arrogant as to suggest to people that they have no say or their opinions are not wanted when it comes to their head of state. I mean, the politicians are going to elect the president. Nowhere else in the world is this type of republic being tried or tested. I've always said it's a Clayton's republic. The real Republicans are going to be arguing. And that's, as I said, that's not ACM. These are the real Republicans. This is what Ted Mack and Peter Reith have made it quite clear they're going to be arguing. They're going to argue that this type of republic is actually going to reinstitutionalise political discrimination. That's a pretty harsh word. David, you're saying, how can you say this is going to be political discrimination? Because this is what the real Republicans are going to say. Look at history. Australia argued and was the first nation to embrace female suffrage. I mean, we were the first people to say, okay, females should, in South Australia, females have the right of the vote. It took us a little bit of time, but we also, 30 years ago, successfully argued that Aboriginals should get the vote. But now the ARM's trying to tell us, you know, that the most elite of elitists, the parliament, the politicians, are the only ones that are going to get the vote for the president. Well, what have we been fighting for? These Republicans, these ARM Republicans, these Yes Republicans are trying to tell us, okay, we've given everybody the vote in Australia and we've been visionary in doing that, but now when it comes to the very last job, when it comes to the president that we want you to have, well, we'll take that responsibility ourselves, thank you very much. We'll just hand it over to the most elite group in the country, that is the parliamentarians, the politicians. Now, with all due respect to Fred Nile, who I've known for quite some time, I don't trust those parliamentarians collectively to make that decision. I don't. And forgive me for being a little bit disrespectful, but these are the guys that have gone around over the last 100 years and made some very, very silly decisions that have forced us, the people, to vote them out. The idea of a democracy is that we can absorb people's political vision, and if we don't like it, we can vote them out. So that's the election of the president, the dismissal. Another reason why most real Republicans are opposed to this type of republic. The dismissal is all about the Prime Minister being able to get there first. Nowhere else in the world does the Prime Minister get to sack the President. Nowhere else in the world. The Prime Minister will be able to sack the President at a whim. The Prime Minister can just go down to Yarralumla and say, right, you're dismissed. Now, the irony is that the President can also sack the Prime Minister under this model. These guys are going to have a Mexican standoff. These guys are going to be walking around when the heat is on. They're going to be walking around trying to argue and try to justify why they individually shouldn't be sacked. These guys are going to be walking around and making sure that they're the first one to sack the opponent. It's going to be easier for the Prime Minister to sack the President than it is to sack his driver. Now, I've copped some criticism for saying that in The Australian over the last couple of days, but it is a fact. Even with Peter Ruth as Minister for Industrial Relations, the Prime Minister can sack the President easier than he can sack his driver. The President the issue will be debated in the Parliament within 30 days, but even if the Parliament rejects the Prime Minister's advice, the Prime Minister is under no obligation to reinstall the President. What type of republic is that? The President is impotent. The President is going to be an expensive member of the Prime Minister's personal staff. The President is going to be so scared of upsetting the Prime Minister, he will not at all, at any time, challenge the legality of any of the Prime Minister's moves. Now, can you imagine if that happened in 1975? Can you imagine if the President could, if the Governor-General could be sacked by the Prime Minister on the spot in 1975? The Governor-General would not have taken the moves that he had made. He would not have made the decisions that he had made in fear of being sacked by the Prime Minister. Now, they're going to say, well, the Prime Minister, the Republicans will be coming back to us and saying, well, the Prime Minister can sack the Governor-General. No, he can't. The reality is he can't. He has to seek the Crown's approval to sack the Governor-General. That will take 10 days, constitutional experts tell us, which is as good as a cooling-off period as you're going to get in politics. So there's that triangle. The Governor-General, the Crown and the Prime Minister. Nobody can sack the other one, but for one of them to be removed, two of them have to agree. I mean, the closest thing we're going to get to perfect government is the system of government we've got now. And I agree with some of you people here that there are parts of our constitution that we should change. So let's look at those bits of the constitution that aren't working. This part of our constitution is clearly working. But the dismissal process that they're going to recommend to you, the dismissal process that they want as a cornerstone of the republic that they're going to enforce, they're trying to enforce on you on the 6th of November, allows for nothing to replace that check, that balance between the head of state and the Prime Minister. The impeachment process. This is a funny one. I mean, the Republicans have decided that this President that they're going to enforce upon you cannot be impeached. So if the President goes and misbehaves, and we all know that Presidents have a tendency to do that, the President cannot be impeached. There is no impeachment process. That means that the President is answerable to nobody bar the Prime Minister. If this President breaks the law, but is doing the job so far as is doing all the dirty work that the Prime Minister wants him to do, he will not be impeached. How fair is that? This guy will be the only person in Australia that is not answerable to his boss, that is, the people. Every other politician, every other member of parliament, every other senator, every other state MP, every other councillor and mayor is answerable to the people because every other member of parliament, every other politician has to go for election at some stage. Not this guy. The only person he has to keep happy is the Prime Minister. And we all know what type of a dangerous environment that will set up. If the Prime Minister sees that the President's doing his bidding, the Prime Minister is going to let the President get away with all sorts of behaviour. Now, if I hear one more Republican tell me that they're going to be voting yes because they're sick of lining up in the aliens queue at Heathrow Airport, I'm going to puke. Right. These guys should be grateful that they've got a lifestyle that they can go to Heathrow Airport. And if you want to challenge your constitution because you're caught up in a line, well, you know, stop shopping at Woolies. These guys have got to realise that the importance of this debate revolves around our system of government. The importance of this debate revolves around who is going to be our head of state. I'm quite happy with Sir William Dean as our head of state, but they want the president. Okay, well, how's he going to be appointed? He's going to be appointed by the politicians. He's going to be recommended by a group of 32. Okay, this group of 32 is going to be appointed by the going to be representatives of the Parliament and some of the Prime Minister's mates. Now, I have faith in John Howard in appointing some bipartisan people, but I don't have faith in some of the other people that are pretenders to the Prime Ministerial throne. So these 32 people are going to make recommendations. Now, the Republicans are saying, OK, that's great, because it's inclusive. It's inclusive. 32 Australians representing 18 million people is not inclusive in my mind, but nevertheless, it's more inclusive than what the Prime Minister is doing at the moment. Fine. Do you know that the Prime Minister can ignore any recommendation from that appointments committee? The Prime Minister can ignore it. Any Australian can make a recommendation to the Prime Minister for the presidential position, and every recommendation from every Australian can be rejected by the Prime Minister. There is nothing stopping the Prime Minister from ignoring every single recommendation and appointing his own friends. Well, the Republicans say, but Kerry Jones, but David Elliott, but David Flynn, he has to be seconded by the opposition leader. Well, the legislation actually says the Prime Minister will appoint the President and seconded by the nomination will be seconded by the opposition leader, brackets, if any. Is there something they're not telling us here? I mean, are they going to say to us next that there is no leader of the opposition? The position of leader of the opposition in the Australian political system, like most other Westminster systems, is there by convention. But with the change in the Constitution, there's no guarantees that those conventions will remain. I mean, so the Prime Minister can make his own nomination and put it to the Parliament. And he can get two-thirds, if he can get two-thirds of the majority of the Parliament, well, that nomination will go through in a dictatorial fashion. The Republicans are saying, oh, but MPs, but no government will get two-thirds of majority of Parliament. Well, little history lesson. Seven times since the war, some governments have had a two-thirds majority. Now, the Republicans are also scared, and we mentioned it in the ad, that this is going to become a debate on the flag. Well, it probably will. And I'm basing that on the fact that most of the senior members of the ARM are also founding members of AusFlag, something that they're trying to get right away from, something that Neville Wran and Malcolm Turnbull and Nick Reiner are trying to forget. But they are the founding members of AusFlag. AusFlag was the organisation that was formed to change the Australian national flag. They've got a problem with the three Christian crosses in the top left-hand corner of the flag. They think that's somehow colonial. That somehow represents England, they say. Another history lesson, those three Christian crosses are the crosses of St Andrew, St Patrick and St George. St Andrew was a Hebrew, St George was an Armenian, and St Patrick was a Welshman. I mean, that was the original sign of multiculturalism. But no, they want to change it because it represents something that is foreign, that represents England, and they want to be part of another global organisation. Well, just remind those Republicans that those three Christian crosses represent a country that was the first one there when the balloon went up in East Timor. Their beloved America was nowhere to be seen. Cheryl Kernow made me laugh last week. She said, oh, you know, in East Timor, the British weren't anywhere near it when the flag went up in East Timor. Well, yes, they were. The British were there. They were the first country to put their hands up and offer a battalion of Gurkhas. The Americans were nowhere to be seen. Who were the second two countries? Well, then there was New Zealand and then there was Canada, all constitutional monarchies. The fourth country, the first Asian country to come to our systems, was Thailand. It, the Republicans won't tell you, is also a constitutional monarchy. So if they're so concerned that this is going to be some sort of international debate and that the people of Australia are going to look like fools for embracing a flag and embracing a system of government that is somehow foreign, well, forgive me, but the Commonwealth, the Brotherhood of the Commonwealth, in our most recent times, has been the first organisation there to defend us. And again, it's something that they are not going to want to debate. It's something we have to remind them and the electorate of. We have to remind the voting public that the Australian flag is also at risk. There is nothing that they can say that is going to change that. The Republican movement is reflective of the Australian the AusFlag organisation. Last week, I spent a week travelling around regional New South Wales, went to southern New South Wales, went through the south coast and Wagga. The first question that was asked out in the bush was the cost. Now, the cost so far is $120 million. The budget's blown out. The cost of the referendum so far is $120 million. That is part of the democratic process. I have no criticism of that. But in 1999, should be wasting the $1 billion that experts are arguing it's going to cost to change to a republic. those of you who don't have an emotional opinion as to whether or not we should become a republic or a constitutional monarchy, this is probably the piece of the argument, the piece of the debate that is going to influence you the most, because we have to change everything. Now, I mean, we have to change our currency, we have to change our flags, we will probably have to change our flags, we have to change all the stationery, all the military, all the police services, the courts, the list goes on. And Michael Hodgman said in this place 2 weeks ago that he had a he had information and advice from Treasury in Canberra that it was going to cost well over $1 billion. Now, that's a lot of Collins-class submarines. And it's something that we've got to really consider. Is this the right time for us to be spending $1 billion on changing a constitution that actually works? Part of that $120 million is the $9.5 million neutral advertising campaign, which some of you have seen with the road signs. Mr. Beasley, the opposition leader, has said that he wants that scrapped and the money sent to East Timor. You're going to have to forgive me for this indulgence, but from Kim Beasley to start talking about soldiers' welfare is probably the most ironic part of this whole debate. I've said this to Fred before, because Fred and I served in the same brigade. When I was doing my recruit course as an 18-year-old soldier, and Kim Beasley was the Minister for Defence, we used to have to sleep with our pillowcases over our faces to stop the asbestos from falling through the roofs in the barracks. Mr. Beasley was such a friend of the soldiers that he used to make us and allow us to sleep in barracks that had been condemned since the 1960s. We actually got field allowance for living in those barracks. Mr. Beasley was also the Minister for Defence who allowed our defence budget to dwindle from 2.7% GDP to 1.7% of GDP. But no, there's political opportunity here, so now Mr. Beasley wants to use his the fact that our Defence Department is in a spending funding crisis to pursue his own goals, to pursue his own agenda. Most people have got to look right through what the advice that Kim Beasley is giving us. And he's also talked about the head of state. Who is the head of state? Well, I'm going to argue, and I accept that this is an arguable point, I'm going to argue that the Governor-General is a head of state. Why? Why am I going to argue? Because Paul Keating in 1995 told the Parliament, in July 1995, told the Parliament that the Governor-General was our head of state. In the last Keating government directory, 1995, Mr. Keating gave the job description of the Governor-General as being our head of state. Now, Bankstown boys don't lie, as most of you are aware. This guy has told us that the Governor-General is our head of state. When he was Prime Minister, one of the first things he did was make sure it was in Hansard and make sure it was in our Commonwealth Government Directory that the Governor-General was head of state. But he wasn't the first one to say the Governor-General was our head of state, because, in fact, Gough Whitlam, when he made Queen Elizabeth the Queen of Australia, also used that opportunity to highlight the fact that the Governor-General was going to be the head of state. Under the Whitlam government, the Governor-General would travel the world and be received as our head of state. It was under the Whitlam government that this was done, and it was done deliberately, and rightly so. One of the things that Gough did do right was ensure that the Governor-General would be treated as our head of state. And Paul Kelly, that great Republican writer for The Australian, in his book on the dismissal, praised that decision by Gough Whitlam. Paul Kelly praised that decision by Gough Whitlam. He highlighted the fact that Australia needed its own head of state, so it was great that we had one in situ, and it was great that we would ensure that the Governor-General would be treated as our head of state. That's my arguments. That'll be my arguments over the next 24 days. And it's something that is going to be debated and debated and debated. I'm confident, and I hope you are as well, that these arguments stand up. But let's talk about the campaign, because that is what I'm sure some of you as politically astute and active people in your respective electorates are interested in, because this campaign is unique. It's been run by the Labor Party. It's been run by the Liberal Party. It's been run by certain sections of the National Party. It's been supported by the ACTU, leaders of the ACTU, the ACTU hierarchy, and of course the multitude of millionaires of the ARM. And you can read Andrew Robb all over it. As somebody who's worked on 17 Liberal campaigns, you can read Andrew Robb all over it, because I've worked under Andrew Robb. He wouldn't know me from a bar of soap, but when I used to work in politics for the Liberal Party, and if we win this, I'm sure I will again, the Andrew Robb campaign handbook has got really six major parts of it. First one is, accuse the opposition of push polling. Tick, Andrew's done that. We got accused of push polling. He got a little bit embarrassed when we responded to the fact that we didn't have any money to poll in the first place, so we don't have any money to push poll, that's for sure. That's been done. Number two, write an open letter signed by popular personalities. All part of the Andrew Robb Liberal Party campaign strategy. Yep, tick, that's been done. We're down there, we've done the open letter, we had that last week. Three Knights of the Realm signed a letter to say that this that there was nothing risky about this republic. Well, I mean, I challenge those Knights of the Realm. If they're so committed to republicanism, I'm sure that Her Majesty would be delighted if they handed back their knighthoods, but they're probably not going to do that. Third part of the Andrew Robb campaign strategy is always produce a feel-good ad early up. He's done that. We've seen it over the last 2 weeks. We've seen the Seekers and we've seen some of the other parts of the hierarchy, the warm and fuzzy part of the ARM campaign. Ironically, can I just comment on the ARM's ad? We've got Gough Whitlam all over this. Next week, or late this week, the Labor Party are relaunching the It's Time campaign. They've got the Seekers singing I Am Australian. Is there some sort of a theme there? You know, 1975, we've got the Seekers, we've got Gough Whitlam, we've got It's Time. Is this revenge for 1975, this entire campaign? Maybe. Maybe, but what makes me laugh is that it's 1975, you know, that was 25 years ago. I mean, we're supposed to be the ones, you know, we're the ones being accused consistently of living in the past. There is not a unique or new part of their campaign. The entire campaign has been dragged out, dusted off out of the newsreels, and yet we're accused of being living in the past. I mean, James Blundell, his song is certainly nothing from the past. This campaign, so far as ACM's concerned, is full of vision, and it's full of vision because we're going to be reminding people of the benefits of our system and telling them that the future of our system can be is just as reliable as the past. But anyway, the ARM thought it was important that, and the Andrew Robb campaign handbook said that it was time to produce a feel-good ad. That was done. Fourth, I was nearly concerned yesterday. I was getting concerned yesterday because I thought the fourth part of the Andrew Robb campaign handbook wasn't going to evolve, but it did, because the fourth golden rule is to lodge a complaint against the opposition's ad, and that came yesterday. Wendy McCarthy put out an application to have the song that you just saw, which hasn't even only started today, but she wanted to get in early. She decided yesterday she'd campaign to have our ad taken off the air. To me, that just stinks of desperation. I mean, before our ads are put on the air, Wendy McCarthy wants to take them off. Well, her complaint, like the Republic on offer, is flawed, because everything in our campaign is strictly by the book. And we were expecting it because, as I said, it's Andrew Robb's standard operating procedure. Now, what have we got to go? Well, next week, you'll hear Andrew Robb and the ARM argue that we've got the underdog status. This is something that I find very amusing. Andrew Robb and the ARM are going to argue that they've got the underdog status. Why do I find that amusing? Because theirs is an organisation that's had 10 years to make its argument. 10 years they've had to make their argument. They've also got the structural support of the ACTU hierarchy, ALP leaders, senior members of the Liberal Party, and of course, as I said before, the multitude of millionaires of the ARM. We, however, on the No campaign, are a loose coalition of minor parties and ACM. Many of them who have never had political experience before. 30,000 members of ACM, the largest political lobby group in the country, and although it's a political lobby group, you'd be very, very scarce. It's very, very scarce to find somebody who's actually interested in politics, because they're actually involved. They're actually more interested in making sure that the system of government remains apolitical. They've also had enough money to advertise on television since last month. We have not. We start our TV ads today. But they're the underdogs, they're going to tell us next week. They're the underdogs. They've also been able to employ seasoned political campaigners. We, unfortunately, have not. We've got a staff of six. Two of them are volunteers. And everybody, except Kerry, is under 30 years of age. But they're the underdogs, you know. They've got senior Labor Party figures, they've got senior Liberal Party figures and a couple of former premiers versus our organisation, which has got 6 employees, 2 of them volunteers and all of them under 30. But they're going to argue for underdog status. Now, finally, this is my prediction out of the Andrew Robb campaign handbook, they'll be producing a negative ad with negative rap. Look out for that on polling day. If it doesn't occur, I'll stand corrected. But they're the last two of the 6 important golden rules of Andrew Robb's campaigning. So I'll be interested to see when and if that happens. Now, my assessment of this week is that the ARM should probably spend more time explaining their model and less time attacking our campaign. Again, that is a sign of desperation. I mean, I like being part of the robust political debate more than anybody. Some of you are probably aware of that. It's one of the things that fascinates me about politics, the great Australian political environment where you can call everybody everything under the sun and then go and have a beer with them afterwards. I think that's very important. It's a unique part of our political system. Dare I say it reminds me of the army. But this is the business end of the season. It's time to get it's time to realise the critical importance of the campaign. And I think we've got a duty. I think we've got a duty to the electorate to ensure that the debate is now focused on the model and focused on why that model should be defeated. It's 24 days to go, and as I said before, and as I say to my wife, 20 more sleeps to go. But the ARM have got a lot of explaining to do, because if in fact their republic is such a good idea, then every constitutional expert in the country would be supporting it. But they're not, and they're not because there are serious flaws in it. Every constitutional expert, for every constitutional expert that the ARM bring out, and for every former and practising politician that the Yes campaign pushes out, I can assure you the No campaign will bring out too. But it's not going to be about popularity. It's not going to be about personalities. This is a one-issue debate. This is whether or not you want a fundamentally flawed republic versus the system of government that we've got now. So my final warning. Australia's constitution was developed over decades by Sir Henry Parkes and a number of other senior notable Australians. We shouldn't replace it with something that was put together in the last 4 days of a convention to appease a loose coalition of millionaires and political wannabes. I was part of that convention, Peter Collins, my former employer, who's right on 99% of the time, but on this issue he's wrong, thought it was quite amusing that he would bring the anti-monarchist on his staff to the constitutional convention. And I sat there and I was sickened by the deals and the backstabbing and the lobbying and the thuggery that went on over that that 2-week constitutional convention. If I was opposed to this republic for any other reason, it is because of the way that we are, the way that we came to this point in the debate. That constitutional convention was flawed. We're going to compare that last 4 days of the constitutional convention when this model was put up to the decades that went into the thought and the recognition put into the constitution that we actually embraced in 1901, and in my mind, the two paths could never be so different. So I'm finding that it's very important for people to have their questions answered. So that's all I've got to say. And if anybody's got some questions, I'd be delighted to answer them. You'll see them when the neutral campaign sends it out to you in the mail. Everybody will be getting a copy of the Constitution and the 69 amendments, as well as an argument in favour of the change and an argument against change, which has been written by parliamentarians from both sides of the debate. That's an interesting question. I've got enough faith in the Australian people that freedom of religion wouldn't be sacrificed at a personal level if we become a republic. Now, that's my personal belief. I think the mood of the nation would remain unchanged when it comes to things like personal freedom and freedom of religion. I understand where you're coming from, because I think there are a lot of people that consider the Crown acknowledge the fact that the Crown is biblically based, and that is certainly an argument, like the Crown is also the basis of our legal system and the Crown is also the basis of our military system and is the reason why we take oaths. I understand where you're coming from on that regard. I don't want to, as much as I like to see senior members of the clergy support my side of the debate, I don't think that it would be constructive for us to... I don't think it'd be constructive for us to argue that that it would somehow lessen our freedom of religion, because most of you, I think, would have your religious convictions no matter who was head of state in Australia. But it's an important point. I mean, it also comes down to the spirit of the nation. I mean, is it a patriotic argument? Is it a religious argument? Is it a legal argument? I mean, we're all going to vote no for different reasons. And I think that, I mean, what you're saying is reflected by a number of organisations that I've spoken to. Well, let me take the first point first about politicians electing the president. I mean, it's the old argument, what cost democracy? You know, what price democracy? If I was a Republican, and my wife is, my wife's a Republican, I think that it's important that we highlight, it's important that we guarantee everybody has a right to vote. That's a fundamental right of the parliament of a citizen of any country, is the right to choose their head of state. Because different times of the political cycle, different attitudes are embraced. And so, if we're going to say to the politicians, once every 5 years you can choose the president, well, then we are denying ourselves a right to express our point of view. I mean, if you are truly a Republican, if you are truly a Democrat, a small d or big d Democrat, you must realise that that everybody has a right to vote. And it all comes down to sovereignty. Okay, are we going to replace the crown with something that the politicians are going to give us, or are we going to replace the crown with ourselves? That's the argument that a lot of people are saying in favour of a democratically elected president. At least... There is nothing between the head of state and you and I if we have a democratically elected president. But if we have a president appointed by the parliament, the politicians are the buffer zone. And I mean, that does not do responsible government or open government any good. You mentioned something about the Commonwealth, and that's a very, very important point, because despite what the Republicans are putting out in their paraphernalia, it's not automatic. If we become a republic, our membership to the Commonwealth is not automatic. We've got that in a letter from the Secretary General of the Commonwealth. It is not automatic. We then have to reapply for admission. If we change our constitution to become a republic, we then have to change our we have to reapply for admission to the Commonwealth. Now, if we call the Malaysian Prime Minister recalcitrant on the day that that application is being heard, well, then guess what? We're at risk. I mean, the Malaysian Prime Minister is out there at the moment accusing Australians of war crimes in East Timor. So you can imagine what their attitude towards our readmittance to the Commonwealth be. It is at risk. Yes, hopefully the Commonwealth would readmit Australia if we're becoming a republic, but it is not guaranteed. There are no guarantees on this debate. That's why you'll find most of our ads talking about risk, because we really have to balance up the risk. That's an opinion that probably isn't shared. Yeah. Well, then why bother having elections at all? I mean, that's the argument. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that opinion would well and truly be in the minority. I mean, the polls are saying that 50% of the republic, 50% of Australians want, if they have a president, want a democratically elected one. That's all. It could be anything. It could be any nation we can blackball our application to re-enter the Commonwealth if we become a republic, which, again, is risk. Oh, dear, let's just take Mr. Jemison. Yep. Yeah, you. Well, you're right. The unique, I mean, it's the diversity of the crown, really, isn't it? I mean, can she be the crown, or can the crown be the sovereign of more than one country? Well, yes, the Commonwealth's proven that. The head of state is the person who does the job, and the most recent head of state, Governor General, says he is the head of state. He was the head of state. The unique nature of our constitution means that, you know, we've split up the apolitical, non-political part of the constitution, and split up between the sovereign and the head of state who does the work, and they are answerable to each other. Again, I mean, you are right in saying that. I mean, it's what Tony Abbott says. You know, if it walks like a duck and it acts like a duck and it quacks like a duck, well, it's a duck. And the Governor General recalls Parliament, issues the writs, commissions people. Well, he's the head of state. Well, there's no reason why you couldn't. Yeah, exactly. That's a good argument. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's arguments at the moment. That's why we have the Senate elections pretty much the same time as we have the House of Representatives elections. That's why most state governments have referendums at the same time as they have general elections. Yep, that's probably, yeah. Yep. But it's not. That's a good way. Well, no, it couldn't be actually, because then you'd have no government. But who would be the stand-in if the president's been sacked? Yeah, but then you're giving too much power to the prime minister, because then the prime minister would appoint another president who could. Well, that's right. So you've got it in politics, in government, I should say. There are no consistencies, so you've got to make things as consistent as you possibly can. The reason why we have a Governor General who is apolitical is so that when the government, if a democratically elected government does go into crisis, the Governor General takes the role of the government. And can appoint ministers and can administer the government while the people have their say. But if we have a president sacked at the same time, okay, we might find a stand-in president, but who's going to appoint a stand-in president? I mean, the president's been sacked by the prime minister. The prime minister's got to go to the people. The last thing he's in a position to do is appoint a stand-in president. I mean, he might as well appoint himself. Yes, but then what happens if the Prime Minister is re-elected? Well, the Prime Minister. I mean, there's too many. I mean, it's got to try to make this. It's certainly not democracy. Certainly not democracy. Oh well, that's your opinion. That's an opinion shared by a lot of people. That's exactly right. I mean, it's those reserve powers it's the unwritten reserve powers that probably make our system of government so important. Couldn't possibly comment on that with a Fairfax journalist in the room. I mean, all media organisations, bar probably two or three, have made it quite clear that it is their editorial position to support the Republic. What they're not telling you is that the devil's in the detail, and what a lot of them aren't reminding their readers and their listeners, that the reason why they're entitled to editorial opinion is because we have a democratically elected government that and a constitution and a crown that guarantees freedom of speech. But anyway, yes, you're right. I mean, it is their right, and it is any news media's news organisation's right to be entitled to editorial opinion. However, my argument in the current debate is that some of them are mixing up news with editorial, and the news attitude is being, and the news angle is being clearly biased.
That's my personal opinion. I mean, I've worked in police media during the Police Royal Commission. I've worked for the Black Police, for the Army during the Black Hawk investigation. You know, worked with John Howard during the GST election. I've seen some media bias in my time, but clearly this one is the worst, and I think that most media observers would agree that this is the worst example that we've ever seen. And if the no case wins, I think there's going to be a lot of journalists and a lot of media organisations with a lot of egg on their faces. And I got a... Somebody wrote to me the other day and he said, our slogan should be, annoy the media, vote no. And I think I'm going to... I think I might get a badge with that. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point. It is a very interesting point. I mean, the Republicans have a problem with one link to the United Kingdom because they claim that it threatens our sovereignty. They've said nothing about the hundreds and hundreds of links we've got with the United Nations and every other economic forum in the world, which has dwindled our sovereignty. I mean, Australian sovereignty is not threatened by the United Kingdom or the Queen of Australia. Australian sovereignty has been threatened by thousands and thousands of treaties and allegiances and agreements that we've signed with the UN and other organisations. And Howard was quite, John Howard was quite right in criticising the fact that most of these were signed in the middle of the night and they weren't even addressed in Parliament. It is just wrong. I mean, it really is wrong. It's unethical. I think we've got a moral obligation to know as citizens, as taxpayers and as people that at any one time should be prepared to defend our country at a time of war and crisis, at least the government can do is ensure that we know when our sovereignty has been dwindled away. I mean, and that's another really interesting part about this campaign. I mean, these guys are saying, at an age of globalism, at a time when everybody's telling us, go global, go multinational, let's link up with Tom, Dick and Harry so that we've got a stronger organisation, they're saying to us to break one. You know, to cut a tie. I don't understand that. When 1 minute Malcolm Turnbull's linking his own personal fortune to the personal fortunes of New York merchant banks, and the next minute he's saying cut our ties with London or United, you know, or the Crown. It's extremely bizarre. And that's when you've got to really question what are the motives behind these guys. Yeah. Yep.
And they seem to disregard the way party politics works.
So yep.
If it's a Labor government, you had a large majority of the Labor politicians all voted to endorse the action of their leader. Otherwise, it would be a political.
Yeah, you're quite right. You're quite right. I mean, yep, that's exactly right. There are, as I said, there are no guarantees in this. And you know, if we have a landslide like we've seen in politics, you know, we saw in the New South Wales state election and the 88th New South Wales state election and the 96th federal election, these guys can overrule whatever conventions the new republic would produce. Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Yep, one more. Yep.
The three judges also said that the president was sacked, the senior state governor.
Yeah.
Then they gave
her. That's a good point. Well, he's wrong. He's wrong because the state constitutions guarantee the Crown. And in Queensland's case, the Queen is actually Queen of Queensland. It's not the Crown. She's actually the Queen of Queensland. So if, as Zellman said, the President is sacked and the most senior governor becomes President, if that most senior governor is the Governor of Queensland, well, it's going to be a vice-regal appointment. So you're just going to have another vice-regal appointment in Yarralumla in place of the President. When is a republic not a republic? Well, it's when the most senior governor who's been appointed by the Crown is sitting in as acting president. Well, I mean, it's... well, she may or may not, but it's enshrined in the Constitution of Queensland. Yeah, it's enshrined in the Constitution of Queensland. I don't think she'd... I mean, she's had a very apolitical attitude towards this debate. I don't think she'd interfere with whatever happens post a referendum. I mean, you can pretty much guarantee that Queensland and South Australia will never, the states in the next 50 years have never become republics. And that's one of the most ill thought out parts of this model. You're still going to have the existence of the Crown just because the Governor General's not there. You know, every state requires a referendum to become a republic, bar Victoria and Tasmania. But in the moment, in Victoria, I don't think anybody would do anything without going to a vote. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, David. We appreciate your coming and sharing with us today on this very important subject. And also, we're just going to pass the donation buckets. If you can help give us towards the lunch, the sandwich and cakes, it costs us about $5 to put that on. If you can help towards that, we'd greatly appreciate it. Now I'm going to ask Reverend Fred Nall now to come and share with us about what's going on here in Parliament. Some interesting things are happening around us this week.
I'd like to add my personal thanks to David for coming along, and I know he's got a very, very heavy program in coordinating the whole campaign, and we appreciate you giving us the time today. Okay, so I think we ought to put our hands together and just thank David again. Thank you. Thanks, David. Thank you. And David just reminded me we have invited him to meet with us on Saturday at 3 o'clock at Greenwood Hall in Enfield. It's on the main road. I think it's 179 Hume Highway or Liverpool Road. And you're very welcome if you want to come along. We've made that an open meeting. We have one every Saturday discussing current issues. And obviously the referendum's the biggest issue that's coming up. And so I have made it an open meeting on Saturday. If you'd like to come or bring some friends who have questions, that's open to both men and women and young people if they'd like to come. David also will be speaking about some of the practical organisation of the polling booths as to who's in charge of the electorates and in charge of polling booths, because it's critical for those of us who are supporting a no vote to make sure that we win. And one of the ways of winning is to have strong teams of people, enthusiastic and energetic, on November the 6th manning the polling booths. At this stage, the Labor Party and the whole union movement, the ACTU, have all come out in favour of the yes vote and are mobilising their two big machines to man the polling booths. And David Elliott, working with CDP and other groups, some of the Liberals, some of the National Party, because the Liberal Party as a whole is not promoting the no vote. They're supposed to be taking a neutral stand. It's made it very confusing as to who will be manning the polling booths for the no vote. And so that's a critical need. And I'm very worried as to whether it'll be as strong as it should be, because I know there's a lot of no votes out there, and people will be voting no vote. In fact, one of the tragedies of this whole debate on the referendum, and it was occurred to me with the strange outburst by Paul Keating last week about East Timor and some of the irrational things he said about John Howard, sort of blaming him for the militia murders up in East Timor. And it was good to see that there's been a massive rejection of his views by the Australian people, including a lot of Labor Party supporters. Thought he went overboard, and they're now punishing Tim Beazley, so his supporters nosedived, and he said himself yesterday it'll keep going down, he thinks, for some time, as a result of Paul Keating's bizarre statements. But what Paul Keating did, he launched the Republican movement. He actually launched the issue of Australia becoming a republic. He personally wanted a republic, and he used the position of Prime Minister and all the prestige it has to get it going. If he hadn't have started, I don't think Malcolm Turnbull and the others on their own could have got it off the ground. And now what we have in Australia, going by the latest polls, is a very serious situation. That vision of Paul Keating has actually now divided Australia right down the centre. For the first time, we're now a divided nation. Instead of a united nation, instead of a nation working together in harmony and cooperation, we're a divided nation. I think even David Elliott emphasised that a moment ago when he said he's the no campaign, a leader, and his wife's voting Republic. Now, it's not going to hopefully cause animosity in his marriage. But there is tension there within our nation between these two points of view. And that, to me, is the most serious outcome of this whole republic issue. I still believe the no vote will just win. But what's the point of it if there's still 49% or something voted for a republic and 51% vote no against republic? We'll have a groundswell of people angry and frustrated they didn't get their republic. That's the danger now, that Australia's divided down the centre. Somehow, hopefully we can get back together and be one Australia. We are all Australians. And so when Mr Keating launched it, he knew it was divisive, but he was prepared to sacrifice Australia for his own personal ambitions. Whereas a very good leader, a statesman, would have said, obviously this is going to antagonise all those who support the Queen or support our constitutional monarchy. Do I want to antagonise all those people? I won't do it. But he deliberately proceeded down a pathway which was going to create a lot of antagonism. And that's what's happening. It's happening within the Parliament. It's happening within the community, within groups and so on. It's happening within the RSL. Mr Priest, the RSL president, is very upset because the Republicans are trying to get hold of some of the old War One veterans who perhaps are not as bright as they would be at their age, and I don't think any of us would be when you get into your 90s and 101, and trying to say, now you want a republic, don't you? And get away from the Queen. And so they're trying to split the RSL, because the RSL has voted as an organisation to support the no vote. And so they've been trying to find people within the RSL to come out on the other side. So it's very, very sad, but we have to do all we can to make sure the no vote wins, and hopefully wins overwhelmingly. I would like to see it get 75% of the vote, but it's hard to see that going by the polls. But then you never know. People may come to their senses just before the vote, and that no vote could suddenly go up the ladder to a very high vote. Then hopefully that would stop the Republican debate. But if it's very close, then the Republicans will then say, we want another referendum on another model, say an elected president. And so in 2 or 3 years' time, we go through the whole thing again, and another $120 million is spent in having that referendum, which may or may not get carried, and so on we go. Just instability now for facing us as a nation. Jeff mentioned about the State Parliament. At the moment, we've got a number of controversial issues before us. We've had now the bill introduced to legalise Australia's first shooting gallery. I know some people aren't sure what a shooting gallery is. It's got nothing to do with guns. It's a term used by addicts that they shoot up when they inject themselves. I mean, if you go to a doctor and have an injection, you don't say, the doctor, shoot me up. You just have an injection. But addicts say they shoot up themselves. They put a needle in their arm, inject the heroin, it's shooting up. So they often get back lanes and other places where they gather, and where they inject, they call that place a shooting gallery. And they're illegal. I mean, that they are around Sydney. I was... A year ago, I was driving through Redfern very late at night, coming back from a meeting I addressed to the Aboriginal people there, and Peter Walker, he said, I'll show you the shooting gallery. And there was a laneway, virtually in darkness, and in the shadows you could see people there sitting and standing, injecting themselves with heroin. That was the shooting gallery in Redfern. But what the government has done is put a bill up to introduce the first legal shooting gallery in Australia's history. At this stage, no one's sure where it's going to be. They're saying St Vincent's Hospital. I'm pretty sure it won't be in the hospital. It'll probably be a shop front place, I would think, in King's Cross in the main road, but we'll have to wait and see where the government finally puts it. They do want the Sisters of Charity to run it. They've apparently volunteered to run it, which is, again, a sad aspect of the whole issue, where Catholic sisters who are like nurses, their job is to care for patients, not supervise them injecting a harmful addictive drug into their veins or injecting anything into their veins, because no one knows, and this is one of the main problems with a shooting gallery. A young person comes in, they'll be asked 2 or 3 questions, as are they over 18 years of age, are you a drug addict, are you a habitual user of drugs, yes, have you got your drugs with you, and so on. And so they'll have to have some heroin with them or have something with them, white powder. And the Sisters of Charity will then actually give them a injection kit of a needle and cotton wool and other things. But actually no one knows what that addict is carrying. They just bought it off the street. It could be caustic soda. It could be heroin broken down with other chemicals which are the same colour. So it looks white or a whitish colour, but no one really knows what it is, even the addict. The addict has to trust the dealer that they're being given a genuine piece or gram or whatever it is of heroin. So what will happen in due course, someone will overdose or be poisoned by what they use to inject themselves with, and someone will die. And then the drug lobby, that's very powerful, even in the Parliament, we've got a very powerful drug lobby. There are politicians in the Green Party and the Australian Democrats who feel the way to go is to legalise drugs, decriminalise drugs, make drugs available. So they will argue, well, let's supply the heroin with the needle in the shooting gallery. So we'll have a display rack with little bottles of heroin or whatever they want to put on show, and the addict will get their free heroin and their needles. That'll be the excuse to save any more overdose deaths. During the Labor Party conference, there was motions put up to have shooting galleries in a number of suburbs. It wasn't passed, but it showed that there's still a strong view out there within the community, and certainly amongst some of the Labor Party members at the conference, and I assume amongst the Liberal Party and other parties, that shooting galleries are the way to go, and we should have one in every suburb. And that may sound strange to you, but they did vote at the drug summit to have five. That was the recommendation, 5 shooting galleries. The government's going ahead with 1. But there are people who feel we should have them scattered right throughout Sydney, Cabramatta, Fairfield, King's Cross, Bankstown, country towns, which would really be putting up the white flag of surrender to the drug problem. It would just be simply giving in to the whole problem of drugs. And as well as legalising the actual shooting gallery, the government has had to include in the bill something which they hadn't mentioned up till now. Obviously, if the addicts can carry heroin to a legal shooting gallery, then the police can't arrest them for carrying the heroin. So they've had to change the law, it hasn't been passed yet, but this is the actual law, to have what they call an exempt quantity of heroin of up to 1 gram in weight. So if a policeman, say you were walking down the street, you're going to the shooting gallery, and the policeman is suspicious, or he may see you even buy the heroin off a dealer on the street, which is happening in King's Cross, and the policeman arrests you, and you say, oh no, this is my 1 gram of legal exempt heroin, I'm on my way to the shooting gallery. So I could see eventually the police just throwing their hands up in despair, saying, well, we're supposed to be fighting drugs, and here we can't charge you, even though we've caught you in possession of heroin. We could until this bill was passed. So I think that again will be a complete breakdown in law and order concerning drugs. The police won't know where they are. Even the dealers, who are very clever, could have a stash. In other words, they could have the heroin hidden somewhere in a back corner of a building and just come out with 1 gram of heroin and keep selling that all the time. So whenever the police catch them, I'm on my way to the shooting gallery. So it could actually make it impossible to arrest users of heroin, but also make it very difficult to arrest a dealer, a pusher. Because if I was a pusher, I'd just simply say, I'm on my way to the shooting gallery. You can't arrest me. So I'd ask for your prayers about that bill. We'll be fighting it strongly in the Parliament, and I'll be making these arguments in the Parliament when it comes to debate. And we are moving amendments to say that the police should still have a discretion to arrest that person if they have 1 gram of heroin. At least give the police officer the discretion, if he wishes, if he thinks it's genuine, this person is trafficking in drugs, dealing in drugs, he should charge the person. But the bill actually says he does not have discretion. He can't make any decisions to charge people. So we'll have a number of amendments along those lines, which if the bill's passed, then we'll try and amend it, hopefully to reduce some of the damage the bill will bring about. We're also moving to amend the 18 months trial period to a 6 months trial period. We think 6 months should be enough to see whether it has any value. Hopefully it won't have any value, and it'll be stopped. But it does say there will be a review of the shooting gallery, and there's no indication as to who will do the review. So we're amending the bill to put in it a committee of 6 people, say one from the Salvation Army, one from Drug Watch, one from the Health Department, one from the Police Department, and so on. So we get 6 genuine people, not 6 people who are pushing for the shooting gallery, who obviously were such a great success. It was their idea. And my concern is some of those who are very vocal might be appointed to conduct the review of it. And their review obviously would be loaded in favour of their own idea. We've just had also the government make an announcement about reforming the upper house. You know, there's been some discussion already by me with you in the past And it's come down to now some simple propositions that the government is planning to introduce a bill which will take away the, I suppose, hidden deals that have been done in the past with preferences. They're going to make it that the voter, that's you, you will have to indicate your preference. So if you wanted to vote, say, for the Christian Democratic Party, and then your preferences go to the Liberal Party, so whatever votes we had left over went to them, you'd have to put a 1 in the box of the CDP party above the line and a 2 in the box of the Liberal Party. So, as you know, the ballot paper has a thick black line through the centre. Above the black line, each party has a box if it's a registered party. Below the black line are the individual candidates' names. So they're going to make it possible for you to allocate preferences in two ways, one way or the other. You can allocate preferences along the top part of the ballot paper by giving preferences to a party, say 1 Liberal Party, 2 Christian Democratic Party, 3 Democrats, Australian Democrats, whatever it may be, and that's how the preference will be allocated. Or you can do it below the black line and number 1 to 30 for each individual. Now that'll stop parties doing deals, which they've been doing in the past, to direct your preferences. So you might vote for, you might be a Green and vote, say, for the Forest, Save the Forest Party, but the Greens may give their preferences to the Marijuana Party, and you're opposed to marijuana, but your vote could have gone to the Marijuana Party because that's the deal that they did within their party exchange of preferences. So I think it'll be an improvement, this system, but again, you've got to see these things in practice. Maybe someone's going to find a way of manipulating it, but it seems on the surface to be the way to go. They're also going to make it that to be a registered party and to have a box above the line, you're going to have at least 1,000 members. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on every party other than the Labor, Liberal Party and so on, the big parties, because most of the minor parties, even like the CDP, we have 8,000 supporters, but not everybody wants to be a member. But it means we're going to have to get 1,000 names and addresses and signatures of people who want to be actually members. You won't have to pay to be a member under this system as long as you agree to be a member for the purposes of registration of the party. So hopefully CDP will get at least 1,000. In fact, you need more than 1,000 because if you had 1,000 and 10 died, you'd be then not registered or deregistered. So you need to have more than 1,000. They're going to make it to register a party that you have to pay $3,500 to register the party, and the candidates will still be $500 per candidate. And the other requirement is to have a box above the line, you must nominate a minimum of 15 candidates. So again, that's 15 times $500, $7,500, but they're going to make it that the maximum will be $5,000 per party for candidates. So that's going to create a bit more pressure to find 15 people who are willing to be candidates on the ballot paper. Obviously only one will get elected, at the most 2. Out of the minor parties, but that's the government's plan, because under the Constitution you're supposed to always vote at least 1 to 15 to have a formal vote, and so they're trying to ensure that by voting for one party only, you'll have voted for 15 candidates by putting one in that box for the party. At the moment I'm going to give a speech when we go back after lunch dealing with the gambling bill. We have a bill that the government's put up called Responsible Gambling. I think it's a result of the strong criticism of the gambling epidemic and the fact we have a $90 billion turnover in gambling now, and that 10% of the world's poker machines are in Australia. And so we have serious problems, 330,000 problem gamblers. And so the government's brought this bill in called Responsible Gambling Bill, Responsible Gambling Bill. And so we'll support it, but I think it's a kind of a sop to the public concern, but we'll try and strengthen it to put in some very strong amendments at this stage. They may be in the regulations, but we're not sure until something is regulated finally, to stop, say, advertising, stop hotels putting signs on the outside of their hotels as they do now, you know, poker machines, come and gamble here and things like that, to try to take pressure off the problem gamblers who see all this advertising and they're being sucked in by it. We want to make sure there's no ATM machines anywhere near where gambling is going on, so people can't keep drawing money out of their with their cards. There's some of the practical things that we're going to try and put into that bill. We have our own bill to stop gambling advertising altogether, and that'll be debated tomorrow, Thursday. But at this stage, I don't think we'll have the numbers to get it passed. The government's not keen to ban all advertising for gambling. I wish they would. So whether we'll go to a vote tomorrow, we'll have to just wait and see. But when we do, we'll probably just we'll have some of the crossbench vote for it. But I don't think either major parties will. Any other bills you think I should mention off the cuff? That's some of the more controversial issues that are coming up. Is there any questions you'd like to ask or suggestions? We've given you a copy of the Family World News. In that we put, this is the October issue, and we've got our last couple of articles about the no vote. I think this one has the article by Alistair Webster that's very good. You'd like to read that one, certainly from the Christian point of view. And down here is just some simple answers, questions and answers there about the Republican issue. Obviously the next issue of the paper will be November. It'll be right on the eve of the vote on November the 6th. So we may have a leaflet in there, but won't be obviously full page articles on it at that stage. We hope by then people know what they're doing. Any questions or any points you'd like to make? Yes. I don't think there is, no. But that's a good point you've made. We're saying you can't put a sign up advertising, but obviously if you have a clear glass windows, you can virtually put it under people's nose. Yeah. Right. Well, someone may have said that, but that's one of the problems with governments. They often, when they're introducing things to get your support or reduce your criticism, they might say that, but it's not actually in the bill. I'd have to look at it, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like that describing the... Because I know in recent times, hotels used to in the past, when alcohol was frowned on, were virtually had all painted windows with, you know, advertising on them and nice pictures of people sitting at a table drinking. But under the new kind of hotel casino type approach, they're making the hotels virtually open to the street with just glass windows. You can see the people inside the hotels. In fact, I'd say they've even made larger windows now. Quite often the hotel is completely open, I think, to try and attract people in. So I'll look at that. That's another point we should make, that poker machines should not be visible from the street. Okay. Probably home, I suppose. I don't think I'll be up in King's Cross or in the harbour. But, I suppose as far as what's coming up in the millennium, we are planning an Australian drug summit in January, which is our first event. That'll be on the 22nd, 23rd of January. And we want to try and bring all the experts together who are concerned about drugs, doctors and so on, and counteract some of this false propaganda coming out, the myths about drugs. I should also remind you, of course, we have our citizens' dinner coming up on the 8th of November, Monday the 8th of November. And Ian, if you could tell Jeff you'd like to reserve a place at it, you could send your money in later or pay on the night when you get there. It'll be here at Parliament House. And we're flying Margaret Court from Perth to be our guest speaker. She's a famous Australian tennis champion who's become an outstanding Christian leader in Perth now. I don't know whether she was a Christian when she was a tennis champion, but she certainly is a very active Christian now, very outspoken and very active in leading a church in Victoria, in Perth called the Victory Church. So we're very pleased she's coming and be guest speaker, and we'll have about 10 leading citizens getting their citizens' awards, including Mark Taylor, the cricketer, will be getting an award, and a number of people of that calibre. So it's a very wonderful, inspiring night. And I hope you can come. I know it's a bit expensive, but that's because we have to pay the Parliament for the meal at night, and so we don't make any money out of it. But it does make it a bit expensive. But I hope you'll make an effort to come. And 6:30 on a Monday night, November the 8th, 6:30. And when's it finish? Yeah, about 9:30, yeah. So we hope to have about 300 people come. Yeah, Reverend Mishu. Recording the vice place down, make sure this line is All right, Jeff, you got a job. Yeah, we do have some other tapes of his speeches, though, and videos, too, so not there, yeah, and had them from the conference as well. And then the following weekend, the 12th and 13th and 14th, we had booked the Southern Cross College at Chester Hill near Bankstown for the annual national convention of the CDP with delegates from other states, but also from New South Wales. And again, that's open to all Christians, not just people who support the CDP, just Christians in general. Hopefully those who have helped us as workers and supporters will come. But we've opened it for Christians because it'll have a lot of information from an excellent panel of speakers. We have, I don't know if there's any leaflets here, is there, about it? Might be nice to get a few of those. I think Belinda has some left. We have got some brochures where you can register for that convention. We might just give you some before you go and before we just close in prayer. But we have people like Reverend Dr. Gordon Moyes as a guest speaker, Peter Daniels from Perth, Reverend Ross Clifford, the head of the Baptist College. June Daly Watkins is going to be one of our guest speakers. She's become a very keen Christian through the witness of her daughter. And she normally only speaks to girls or women, but she'll be speaking at that convention on how to be a leader and your personal presentations and so on. So I've met her a number of times. She's a lovely lady, and you men would never have probably met her yet. It's a good chance to meet June Daly Watkins. Used to be a former Miss Australia and so on. So we've got a great lineup of speakers coming for that convention as well. And you can travel there each day. You needn't stay there, but there is accommodation available at the college. But as it's in the Sydney suburbs, it's probably cheaper to drive there each day and just attend or come by train to the convention. We'd love to have you there. And Men for the Family, Peter Daniels is a guest speaker, a keynote speaker at the convention, and as he's in Sydney, he's agreed to speak to Men for the Family. Usually he gets paid between $6,000 and $10,000 to speak. He's a man in demand all around the world. He speaks to corporations like BHP and Westpac and to all their executives on how to be a leader in the modern society, on leadership training and those type of issues. And he's agreed to be our speaker at the convention and here at no charge to CDP. He's donating his time and coming across with his wife from Perth, from Adelaide, where he lives. So he's a very inspiring man, Peter Daniels. So you'll hear some interesting stories from him and his contact with world leaders. Any other questions? Or we might just close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we ask you to go with us now, and we just pray for your guidance and direction with this referendum vote on November the 6th. We feel in our hearts that the no vote is the way to go. We're not saying our constitution is perfect and doesn't need updating and improvements as time goes on, but not this radical change that's now proposed. We just ask for a great victory that even as people are undecided at the moment, a great number, that they will come down to a conclusion that what we have is a very good system. It does work. It has given us one of the best democracies in the world, and one where we all have our freedom of speech and religion, and that why should we wreck it? So we just pray, Lord, to give us a great victory on November the 6th. Raise up more than enough workers to man the polling booths, and that may the publicity and literature and TV ads have a powerful impact on those who see them during these next couple of weeks. So go with us now and help us to serve you in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Amen. Thank you, everyone.